Chapter 6. 10 years.
I love my children. I just smother them with so much love and affection. They're just like mommy off. But I'm like, I got so much. It's fine. I hope it's all. Yesterday I said, Herbert, do you feel loved? And she's like, of course, Mama. What are you talking about? I said, I just want to make sure I'm doing a good job. And Finley said, you're doing a great job, Mama. We know you love us. I was like, okay, I just want to make sure. I feel like I smother them to death, but you never know.
As I mentioned in the preface, when my mother sat for the interviews that form the basis of this book, she wasn't in a place where she could recount all the great, fun times in her life. She focused mostly on the trauma. Accordingly, there is much less material on the tapes about the years between her divorce from Michael Jackson and her marriage to Michael Lockwood, a gap of about 10 years in which she created a magical life for me and my brother, and was surrounded by a large group of devoted friends. These years constitute some of the happiest times of her life, but they were also years in which the scale of her life ballooned to almost a breaking point. Fortunately, my mother told me everything about her life, which again could sometimes feel like a curse for me as her daughter, but I was happy she did when I was working on the book. So much of the material in this chapter is my recollection of what she told me. In Florida, we lived in an area called Bel Air. There was a sort of swampy, southern feeling to the place, with fireflies and alligators and the trees covered in moss. We lived in a big, old house. To the right of the front door, there is a bedroom, and I am peeking through the door. It is dark in the room. All the shades are drawn, even though it's daytime. I'm watching my mom shushing my brother. He's on her shoulder. I remember the rhythm of it, the shh, 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 three notes repeated over and over. I realize now that this was my first understanding of the depth of her maternal instincts. My mom had the strongest such instincts of anyone I've ever met. Eventually, it would be clear to me that should anyone hurt Ben or me, she'd probably track them down for as long as it would take, like in a Western. This was the presence you could feel in her. And it wasn't small. It was terrifying. Something else that's terrifying. I only have fond memories of Ben, but my mom once told me that shortly after he was born, I said, I wish all the babies in the world would die. Clearly, this was my way of saying I felt upset about this baby. I had an instinct that Ben was the love of my mom's life. My brother and I often would talk about how magical our childhoods were. Maybe it was just the time and the place. Maybe we were just lucky to find ourselves in some kind of golden moment. What was certain was that we had extraordinary parents who wanted us to have joyful childhoods. My mom got us a nanny each. I had Idy, who was a teenager. But Ben had Uant, who was from South Africa and in her 60s. Her real name was Suzanne, but he couldn't pronounce that. Uant was so great for him. They'd play in the garden all day, watering plants and getting muddy. When Ben learned to talk, he developed a bit of a South African accent from being with Uant all the time. Ben had curly ringlets down to his butt, and a lot of people thought he was a girl. He loved being in nature, a little nature boy, and he was sweet, soft, and gentle, an old soul. Just as Elvis had with his mother and my mother had with Elvis, my brother and my mom had a kind of I can't live without you relationship. They shared a very deep soul bond.
Ben was very similar to his grandfather. Very, 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 and in every way. He even looked like him. Ben was so much like him, it scared me. I didn't want to tell him because I thought it was too much to put on a kid. We were very close. He'd tell me everything. Ben and I had the same relationship that my father and his mother had. It was a generational fucking cycle. Gladys loved my dad so much that she drank herself to death worrying about him. And then my dad had his demons and acted out on them. I have everything in me that wants to do the same thing. And then my sons got the same genetic makeup. I feel like he's more genetically me than Danny. Ben didn't stand a fucking chance.
When I was about 7 years old, we moved to a new house a bit further north in Clearwater on Osceola Avenue. Our dock was on the ocean. Ben and I would jump off that dock into the mud when the tide was out, rolling our whole bodies in it, covering ourselves in this disgusting ocean ooze, playing with the seaweed and the dead fish and the shells. Some days we'd go find lizards, and we figured out that if you pushed on the belly of one, it would open its mouth, and when you let it go, it would snap shut. That's how Ben could wear them as earrings. In our backyard, we had a pool. And at some point every day, my mom would yell from the house to get out when the thunder and lightning came, though we'd always try and stay in the water. It was more fun when it was raining and when the sky lit up. My mother's favorite thing to do was take us to the park by the lake to go on the swings. She liked going on the swings, not pushing us on them. Her two rules in Florida, which we'd hear often, were you can't swim in the rain, and if an alligator chases you, you have to run in zigzags. My mom would take us out into Clearwater Harbor on jet skis, doing donuts and throwing everyone off the back. It was that same energy she had at Graceland with the golf carts, totally wild. She once threw her mom off the back, then freaked my grandmother out by pretending there were sharks coming for her. Other times we'd head across the harbor to a tiny island covered in sand dollars. We'd collect them, bring them home, dry them out, and then crack the Aristotle's lantern open to find these little dove-like shapes, which were actually their teeth. Poor things. I still feel bad for the lizards and the sand dollars, and my grandmother. My mom would take me to the sandcastle to get frozen yogurt in a cone, just me and her. We would have the music blaring in her black Mercedes. Always a black Mercedes. And we listened to Toad the Wet Sprocket. It was the 90s, and Tony Braxton and Mark Morrison's Return of the Mac, though my mom loved all R&B. My mom would always sing along in the car, but in a self-conscious way, as though she didn't want anyone to hear her. I didn't understand back then why she was scared about music. After the divorce from Michael, my mom started having panic attacks. This is why she took us out of LA and to Florida to begin with. They were so severe that she was in and out of the hospital. Even in Florida, she had to put aluminum foil over the windows so the paparazzi couldn't take photos of her. She had her gallbladder removed and the mercury taken out of her teeth, but nothing helped because it wasn't just physical. She was having a sort of mental breakdown. Just as my mother used to pick up the phone to listen in on conversations between Elvis and Ginger Alden, I once unwittingly picked up the phone in Florida in time to hear my father, who had just seen a photo in the press of Michael Jackson, my mother, me, and Ben say, "Get my son off that guy's fucking lap." I quickly hung up the phone. Strangely, this was the first time I realized my father was upset about my mom's marriage to Michael. That's how well they protected us from their adult problems. Despite his hurt, my father recognized that my mom needed help and flew to Florida to look after all of us. She told me later that that was the last time they hooked up. My mom desperately wanted to get back together with my dad. She believed she'd broken up her family and felt immense guilt. But my dad couldn't risk being that vulnerable again. At night, my dad and his friends would sit on the balcony of our house and play and sing while the tropical storms came through. One night, my mom and my dad and all of us sang Leaving on a Jet Plane together while the weather raged. Both my parents loved the rain and hated the sun. They had chosen my brother's middle name, Storm, during Tropical Storm Earl.
I really had no prototype to follow growing up. I had no family life. No home life to be an example, ever. No stability. I didn't feel any emotional attachment to my grandparents who seemed to be perfect, who did all the right things and made all the right moves, who got married and had kids and stayed married until they died. I guess I didn't really have a shot in hell. If something is not interesting to me anymore, I'm out of there. And whenever you get with a new person, the whole thing, the beginning, middle, and the end, will play out in 2 years. That's why I got married multiple times. When I had Riley, I set my mind solely on having a child and raising a child. Was my goal for her to have suitable parents who were stable, and were Danny and I going to stay married forever? No fucking way. Neither of us had that in our minds, but we were a different kind of soulmates and always ended up living in the same house somehow.
My parents began to record music in my mom's garage in Florida. These would become some of the songs on her very first record. They would write during the day, and at night we'd all go get frozen yogurt or go to a movie theater to see something. My mom always got a medium popcorn and a red icy. She was usually very protective of us, making sure we didn't see anything too grown up. I remember seeing Flubber at the local theater, but I also remember being dragged to see Titanic. She kept her hands over my eyes during the entire sex scene in the car, so I was allowed to see the catastrophe of the sinking ship, but not the boobs. She inherited the modesty from my grandmother. Some days she'd take us to the Dairy Curl in Clearwater to get chocolate-dipped ice cream cones. While our parents were recording in the garage, Ben and I would ride our bikes around the front yard. Every afternoon around 3, our neighbor would come out on the porch of his old Victorian house, sit on a chair facing the ocean, and play the fiddle. Me and my brother would climb our kumquat tree so we could see over the high walls. And there we'd sit, eating kumquats, watching the man play. Once he finished, we'd climb back down and head out to the front yard and the ocean to search for manatees, but we never found any. Once my mom fully recovered, we all moved back to California, back to the house we'd left behind. Our house in Hidden Hills, about 30 miles west of downtown LA, would turn into our real childhood home. My father had found it for us. We lived there till I was 21. It was a very special place, though it has since been torn down. There weren't a lot of celebrities around there back then. It was a horse community and everybody had one. My mom liked that it was far away. She liked that no celebrities lived there. We had 5 acres. There was a swing out front on a huge old oak tree, fruit tree groves in the back, the main house, another full-sized house, and 2 guest houses. I remember going to see the house for the very first time. When I laid eyes on the swing on the 600-year-old oak tree, I was sold. The main house at Hidden Hills was rustic with stone fireplaces and wood beams. Snakes would get into the house sometimes, and at night we'd hear the coyotes howling, great horned owls hooting. Sometimes I'd turn a bathtub faucet on and spiders would come out. We'd often find tarantulas in our backyard. I would bring them to school in jars as my show and tell. My mom's assistant and her son lived with us. He was our godbrother, and he and Ben and I would just roam. We were crashing bikes and running off finding snakes and getting cuts and falling into rose bushes, running amok like my mom had done at Graceland. I think we were protected by angels because none of us ever broke a bone, even when we fell off swings or crashed golf carts. Once, my brother flipped his golf cart. His had off-roading tires and decapitated it. Somehow he was fine. Along with the horses and 7 dogs, we raised goats and chickens and peacocks. Ben and I would spend hours, sun up to sundown, playing in those orchards behind the house. We would imagine ourselves into worlds we created, constantly coming up with games and spending hours in the trees playing make-believe. We would climb the apple trees and the plum trees and the pomegranate trees until we cracked open a pomegranate and ate the soft insides. My brother's nanny, Uant, would ring a bell at 4 o'clock for tea. Tea and crumpets and jam. Like some colonial British version of her South African upbringing. My mom curated all that for us. It was her version of Graceland. The decade after Michael Jackson was her best time outside of the Tarzana days with my dad, when things were simple. She had so many friends who really loved her. We would joyously travel the world together as a pack of 25 people. Fun every day, all day. I'd wake up to find a whole bunch of people on the deck, drinking coffee. It was a dreamlike communal life. We were never alone. She was never alone. Because my mother had been a witness to Michael's life, We now had a private chef, 3 assistants, 10 security guards, agents, business managers, friends, so many people coming and going. At all times, all of the houses on the property were full. 3 of my friends moved in with me in the main house, and we even had my mom's holistic doctor living upstairs, plus the 2 nannies. So in all, about 17 people could be living there. And then there were the people who would come by every day. She wrote a song, Thanks, about those friends on her 2005 album, Now What? One day, on one tombstone, all our names should go. We shared a life. The beauty and the ugliness, through all the pain and death, the birth of a child. My mother had a Gaia-like quality, a mystical intuition. Sometimes it felt like Mother Nature lived through her. One morning, my mom and dad were sitting in the kitchen drinking coffee when 2 of her friends, Mike and Caroline, who she had set up and who were now married and lived with us in the upper house, walked in. "You're pregnant," my mother said to Caroline. Mike and Caroline went white. Caroline was indeed pregnant, but only a few weeks, and they hadn't told anyone.
As early as 10 years old, I was talking about past lives. I felt like I'd lived them, could remember them at one point, but I can't remember them anymore. I wish I could. I think that we've lived before, and I feel like the things I remember have something to do with how I died in some other lifetime. I remember when I was young, telling people I was on a horse and buggy or in a carriage at a time when there were no cars. They always thought I was crazy when I said that, but I didn't raise my own kids to think those kinds of things are crazy. My kids would say the wildest shit as early as 3 years old, and I'd just say, "Really? That's cool." I never wanted to say, "That doesn't happen," or "That's not possible," or "You don't know that." I never felt like I had to cut them down like I was when I was young.
Both my parents wanted the world to feel magical to us. My mother would hire a Santa Claus to run through our yard on Christmas Eve. My dad would take us fairy hunting in the forest. My mother's bathroom had a secret little garden attached to it. I always thought it looked like a fairy garden, and I told Ben that's what it was. "If you ask the fairies for presents," I said, "they'll bring them." At the time, he loved to play with my Polly Pocket dolls. And whenever we went into my mom's secret magical garden, he'd ask for a Polly Pocket. One day, I went to the toy store and got him some and tied them to the trees overnight. The next day, he ran in there and I said, "Look what the fairies brought you." As I got older, I entered that phase where a younger brother is a burden. I was around 11 when I got my first AOL account, and I'd rush up to my mom's computer and hope I'd gotten an email. One day, Ben joined me and said, "I have a magical potion for you to drink." This was annoying for an 11-year-old girl hoping to get an email. "Go away, I'm busy on my email." "But it's a magical potion," he said. "No, it's not." "Yes, it is. It's going to make you fly." "No, Ben, it's not going to make me fly," I said, though I did still secretly believe I could fly. I was killing the magic, and I knew it. And he was so sweet, so I said, "Okay, I'll try your magic potion, but it's not going to make me fly. Watch." I took a gulp of it and immediately regretted it. Despite having a mouthful of foul liquid, I managed to ask, "What is in my mouth?" "It's my pee," he said. Then I was indeed flying, just like Ben said I would, down the stairs and the long hallway, all the way to my bathroom. Ben followed me and stood laughing at the doorway as I spat out his magical potion and brushed my teeth with soap over and over again. I went and found my mom. "Ben made me drink his pee," I wailed. "Benjamin," she said. And that was it. He never really got in trouble. All he would ever get was Benjamin. And if he was really in trouble, Benjamin Storm. Everyone loved him too much to stay mad at him. Another time, I chased him into the laundry room, telling him I didn't want to play with him because he was being such an annoying little brother. I remember I had a VHS cassette in my hand, and I was so angry that I lifted it up high like I was going to hit him with it. He started sobbing. I have felt bad about that for my whole life. Like I said, he could just break my heart so easily, because he was the sweetest little boy you could imagine. We went to a private school in Woodland Hills called Lewis Carroll, 3 stop signs down the road from our house. My mom would pick us up at the end of the day, but she didn't really have a lot of interest in our education. We didn't have to be sick. We could just tell her we didn't want to go to school, and she'd say, "Great, you're staying home and hanging out with me." Even on the way to school sometimes, Ben and I would pitch to her all the reasons why we needed to stay home that day. And as we'd be pulling up to school, she'd turn the car right around and pull back out, and we'd end up getting ice cream or going to the toy store. My dad, on the other hand, said we needed an education, a schedule, structure. But my mom ruled the roost, and if she wanted something, that was the way it was. My mom let my father homeschool us at one point. All I remember is him telling us about ancient Egypt, how Orion's belt aligned with the Great Pyramids. To this day, I actually impress people more often with my knowledge of constellations than with my math. A couple years before I was born, Priscilla had a second child, a boy named Navarone. Priscilla was a new mom again, and my mom was a new mom, so they spent a lot of time together because they both had little kids. It became a point of understanding between them, a new start, a burying of the hatchet. Though I know my mom was a bit jealous of Navarone too, because here was this little boy that Priscilla just adored. Nana, Priscilla's mother, was the matriarch of our family and the quintessential grandmother. Whereas Nona, Priscilla, didn't really fit the image of a granny, Nana definitely did. The entire extended family would have dinner at Nana's house in Brentwood every Sunday. She made famous burnt baked potatoes, and we would all put our salad into the potato skins and eat them. Sometimes she'd make us pasta, and we'd eat it with cottage cheese. In fact, my mom would never eat pasta without cottage cheese. She said it was a beaux thing, referring to Priscilla's maiden name. After dinner, my grandmother would always have push pops for all the kids. I felt lucky we had such a big family and so many cousins. I had loads of cousins, maybe 20 in all. And we had the best time for so many years, so much fun and joy, so many trips to Hawaii, a normal family, if famous. We'd spend most Thanksgivings at Nona's, and we would often go up to her house in Lake Arrowhead around the holidays, where we would run wild outside, climbing on boulders and looking for arrowheads while the adults drank wine and watched movies. Nona would regularly pick me up, or my mom would drop me at her house. I probably saw Nona once a week at least. Every holiday, every Christmas, every Sunday, we all spent them together. I was dimly aware that my mom and her mom had had real issues when my mother was younger. But if you look at family photo albums or home videos, you'd see a very close family. Later in our teen years, Navarone and I went to the same school, so often I would sleep over at my grandma's so that we could drive to and from school together. He and I became close. I wasn't aware of the full details of my mother's relationship with her mother until much later. For a long time, they let the past be the past so that Priscilla could be a grandmother for us kids. From my point of view, we were a close, normal family. Those Sunday dinners at Nana's went on well into my 20s. There were a solid 2 decades where our family felt very normal to me. My mom took me everywhere with her when I was a kid. I remember she did a photo shoot in New York with Kevin Aucoin. He made her up to look like Marilyn Monroe. I couldn't believe how beautiful she was and how much she looked like her. Once he was done with my mom, Kevin did my makeup too. I vividly remember his deep voice and his big hands. She would take me to Cartier photo shoots, Vogue photo shoots, and once to a fitting with Donatella Versace. While my mom was trying on dresses, I ran around the studio with Donatella's daughter, Allegra. When we left that day, my mom took with her an extraordinary, very heavy, sequined Versace dress. I'm not sure how often she wore it, but I loved to visit it in her closet. It was magical to me. One of my favorite things to do was sneak into my mom's massive closet when she wasn't home and try on her dresses. She hated it when I took her things. One day, when I was 13, I snuck in and borrowed one of her favorite bags, a black Chanel purse with a gold diamond eagle on it. I was going to Six Flags with my friends, and I thought it would be cool to take the purse. But on a break between roller coasters, I put the bag on a bench behind me, and when I stood up to leave, it was gone. That was the only secret I ever kept from my mom when I was growing up. Eventually, when I was about 20, I told her. I don't think she could even remember which Chanel purse it was. She had so many. I would often find myself at parties with her. When I was around 9 years old, my mom took me to a party at Alanis Morissette's house on the beach in Malibu. My mom didn't really know anyone at the party. She didn't go out of her way to make friends because she was really shy by nature. So I was her friend for the night, which was common. At some point, we got some vegan food. I remember there was a lot of vegan food. And for the rest of the night, we sat alone by a bonfire on the beach chatting. Through the darkness, we realized there were two adults rolling around on the sand making out. My mom covered my eyes. "Don't look," she said. When my mom would go to parties in the Hollywood Hills, if there was a person there who she thought I was a fan of and would want to meet, she would call me to get out of bed in the middle of the night to come wherever she was. One night, after I had fully gone to bed, somebody came in with a phone for me. "I'm at a party," my mom said, "and you'll never believe who's here." "Who?" I said groggily. "Marilyn Manson. Do you want to come meet him?" At the time, I was a big Manson fan, so even though it was a school night and an hour's drive from Hidden Hills to the Hollywood Hills, security took me to the party at Jackie Getty's house. I met Marilyn Manson and then went upstairs where there were some other kids. We tried on wigs all night until the adults were done. Much later, on my 17th birthday, when I was deep in a Led Zeppelin phase and had gotten a Zoso tattoo, my mom called me from Paponi in Brentwood. "Let's have dinner for your birthday," she said. Again, security drove me over. I met my mom in the parking lot. We walked into the restaurant, and there was Robert Plant, waiting to have dinner with us. Most nights I would fall asleep to the sound of a party, the piano being played and people singing, the music loud. Ben and I would sometimes sleep together in the same bed. That was very comforting to us. My mother had other boyfriends, but my dad still lived in the guest house. My mom's routine was the same every single night she was at home. A massage while she watched Nick at Night. Then she would come and lie with us and sing us a lullaby. "Mama's little baby loves shortening, shortening." Or lullaby and goodnight. "Mommy loves you. Daddy loves you." That's usually where the song ends, but she would keep going, naming every single person and animal we've ever met until we fell asleep. "Grandma Janet loves you. Nona loves you. Idy and Aunt love you. All the dogs, Oswald, Ruckus, Lulu, Winston, Puffy, love you." Or my dad would read us The Hobbit. Then they'd both say goodnight. Some nights a bit tipsy and wild, in which case our nannies would sit with us until the sound of the coyotes called me into a dream I always had, a place in which nothing bad ever happened and where we all lived forever in each other's orbits, the closest family you could imagine. Holidays were a huge deal for my mother. Christmas morning, we'd find puppies crawling out of stockings. At Easter, we'd get baby chicks and bunnies. For her birthdays, she would rent out part of Magic Mountain like her dad had done with Liberty Land in Memphis. She loved roller coasters. Zippin' Pippin was the first roller coaster she ever fell in love with. So on one birthday, she just rented out Colossus and went on it about 700 times in a row all night with me and Ben. She made her security guards ride with her until they turned green. We'd have huge Thanksgiving meals with everyone dressed up. Nothing was low-key. She wanted every moment to be extraordinary. But then there were those nights when I would come in her room and find her alone, lying on the floor, listening to her dad's music, crying. It was hard for my mom to have a music career. She was a beautiful lyricist, but she didn't feel like she had real control over her music. I thought it was so brave for her to make a record at all. After a day in the studio, she'd call me and my brother to go sit in her Mercedes and listen to the song she had recorded that day. She'd play it for us very loud, and then we would tell her what we thought. And if we weren't at school because we ditched out or it was the weekend, we'd go with her to the studio. There was even a song that she wrote, So Lovely, about us that we got to sing on. You know I did something right, something that keeps me alive. Oh, you sweet little babies, when you came, you let me know why. I was finally happy. You knew me before now, didn't you? My God, you're so lovely. Did you come here to help me? And I know you can't sleep well unless I'm right there next to you. Oh, you take care of mommy too. You're so quick to defend me, aren't you? Please don't fear to lose me. You know I have those same fears too. My mom loved touring, but it wasn't lucrative for her because she wasn't giving people what they thought they wanted, which was for her to cover Elvis songs. Elvis impersonators would come to her shows. She always dreaded that. She would peek out the side of the curtain before every show to see if any impersonators were in the audience to prepare herself. How weird to have someone wearing a costume of your dead father watch you sing. She really wanted to be taken seriously, but it was kind of never going to happen. Despite the Elvis impersonators, my mom loved the tour life. We loved it too. We'd go on the tour bus with her, sleeping in bunks, going from city to city, in and out of motels to shower and then on to another town, another Cracker Barrel and another Waffle House, sound check, take a nap, play the show. She loved finding local bars and playing and then hanging out. Sometimes she'd invite fans to come back and party with us in the green room after a show.
I loved performing live. Loved the instant feedback, the give and take with the audience. In the studio, you're often in the room by yourself, but live, I could watch people's faces and see how my words or my music affected them. I could always see it in their faces, and then getting to meet the fans and having them tell me what my music had done for them, that was really something. I also really enjoyed interacting with both my fans and my dad's fans. I would try to do it to the best of my ability, almost to a fault. I'd do whatever I could, talk to them, take pictures, whatever they wanted. I would spend a lot of time doing that when I was on the road. I always thought it was important to be gracious and grateful. My songs can be sad and dark, lonely, depressing. But after the shows, people tell me the song saved their lives because they could connect. They too have been in that place and lived that life. I've had so many people come backstage and tell me that even if what I do is dark, it has literally stopped them from killing themselves. Oh my God, somebody else feels this way? I love it when they tell me that. It makes me want to keep doing it.
I saw the pressure of the business from her very first single, Lights Out. Every time the record company sent it to her for approval, it was more countrified, targeting Elvis fans. I remember sitting in her Mercedes saying, I liked the original version, but I don't really like this. The company was resistant to what she wanted, she was resistant to what they wanted, and that's how it went.
I don't like to perform Elvis songs, but I would typically try to do something special for the fans on the anniversary of his death, especially if it was a big year. I did a duet with him called Don't Cry Daddy in 1997 as a surprise for the fans, and then a couple of times after that. These performances weren't part of any record, not anything I sold, except for charity once. I feel like my performing his songs was a little cheesy on the one hand, and on the other, I like having my own identity as much as I can have one. The one time I performed at Graceland in 2013, we played three tracks off of my Storm and Grace album in the Jungle Room. I remember being comfortable because it was my home, but I also got really anal about all the people in there, the wear and tear of the situation. Oh my God, the carpets.
During the making of her second record, Now What?, she would come home and tell us what every song was about. She recorded the Ramone song, Here Today, Gone Tomorrow, for Johnny Ramone, her good friend who had died a year earlier. When You Go was half about me and half about my dad. But one song, High Enough, really stands out now. She wasn't doing drugs at the time, but she was drinking. Some nights, way too much. And the song is very clearly about addiction. But this was way before it. Any of us could have conceived that would become such a problem for her. Though in retrospect, storm clouds were gathering even then. In October 2000, my mother met Nicolas Cage at a birthday party for Johnny Ramone, and on August 10th, 2002, they got married in Hawaii. I was 13. When she met Nick, she had been in a serious relationship for 2 years with a musician named John Ojaka. She and John were passionately in love, and they had been engaged for a while. But he was 6 years younger than she was, and the fact that she had children and an ex-husband still very much in her life made it tough for them. Eventually, they broke up, and she often wondered how her life would have gone had they not. Crazy stuff continued. There were further attempts to poison the well with my dad. For example, people close to my grandmother told my mom that Danny had been selling my mom out to the press. To prove it, they put a PI on my dad for months. At one point, he was playing blackjack for money in Vegas, and the PI followed him there. Then, my dad got a call from two of his friends, Cyndi Lauper and Angela McCluskey, to go meet them at Sundance. And even though he was prone to wearing a top hat and was limping around with a cane after he'd hurt his leg on a motorcycle, the PI still managed to lose him and told my mom that they had no idea where he was. He's stolen a car and done a runner, the PI said. At Sundance, my dad met up with Cyndi and Angela, and they all went to a party for the French band Air. And who did Danny find at the party? My mother, her boyfriend, and her head of security. Hi, Danny said when he saw my mom. My mom's jaw dropped. Her PI had lost my dad, but he had found my mom, like he always did. My mother's relationship with Nick Cage was very short-lived. It felt like something that came in and then left like a Florida storm and was, I think, something of a distraction from her breakup with John. She even ping-ponged between Nick and John for a minute. I remember going in her room and Nick was there one day and then the next day it was John. She clearly couldn't make up her mind. But Nick and my mom had a ton of fun together. I don't know if they were truly in love, though she said they were. He'd bring her diamonds, and every time he'd come to see her, he'd be in a different car, usually a Lamborghini, and always in a different color. I remember a green one, an orange one, a red one, but never the same car twice. My brother, who was 7 years old when they met, could never quite pronounce it correctly. He'd say, "Here's Nick in a Lamborghini." Nick bought my mom two really beautiful old cars. A 1959 blue Corvette convertible and a white Cadillac from the 60s. My mom would drive me and Ben to school in them in the morning. I preferred the Corvette because I loved riding with the top down. On the weekends, we'd all get on a yacht and sail to Catalina Island off the southwestern edge of Los Angeles. On one of those trips, she and Nick got into a fight, and her $65,000 engagement ring somehow ended up in the ocean. She claimed during a later Diane Sawyer interview that it was worth more than that and also that she didn't throw it, but that it was indeed thrown. A diver was immediately called out to try to find it, but there was no chance. At its deepest, the ocean between Catalina and Los Angeles is 3,000 feet. So Nick bought her another ring, this one even more expensive than the first. It was on that yacht that I first saw the movie Jaws. My mom made me and my brother watch it. She loved horror movies, especially if she could watch them in a scary setting. So we saw Jaws on a yacht in the middle of the ocean, Misery while holed up in a ski lodge in Jackson Hole, The Ring in Japan, and Black Christmas on Christmas night stuck in a cabin at Lake Arrowhead. She and my brother loved it, screaming and laughing all the way through, though it was never my thing. In fact, I was completely traumatized. It didn't end with movies. One day at school, my mom showed up dressed as Michael Myers from Halloween. Another time she came as a dead and bloody Marie Antoinette. We got back at her, though. Ben and I would take turns putting the Michael Myers mask on and chasing each other and her around the house. She would be more scared than anyone. After 108 days, her hurricane of a marriage to Nick Cage was over. In that interview with Diane Sawyer, my mom said of the relationship, "We were so dramatic, the two of us, that we couldn't stay contained." For most of my life, my mother kept a house on the Big Island in Hawaii and spent as much time there as she could. She said she felt a connection to the island and could think more clearly there. As I've said, my mom always wanted birthdays and holidays to be a big deal. So for my 16th birthday celebration, a large group of us went to Hawaii, me and six of my closest friends, Ben and two of his friends, my mom and some of her friends, her future husband, Michael Lockwood, and my dad. My mom threw a big party for me on the beach with a guy singing and playing guitar while we ate. My father got me 16 presents. At some point, the guy invited me and my dad to join him on the grass dance floor for a father-daughter dance. My dad and I looked at each other in terror. He was at least four Mai Tais in. Thank God, because fully sober, it would have been even more of a nightmare. We were desperate to get out of it, but my mom was adamant because she thought it would be hilarious. The song the guy chose to accompany the dance was Bob Carlyle's Butterfly Kisses, the one about the daughter being sent from heaven to be daddy's little girl, one part woman and looking more like her mama every day. Nothing against the song, but placing my family members in any type of traditional setting was always going to go poorly. We found the whole thing outrageously hysterical, and my dad and I just gripped onto each other, convulsing with laughter. Everyone at the table cracked up. Like Ben, my dad has an incredible laugh, one that's impossible not to laugh along with. Honestly, during that dance was the hardest I've ever laughed in my life, and not just because me and my friends had been sneaking our own Mai Tais and champagne all night. At the end of the party, we headed back to the house on golf carts to listen to music and keep partying. My mother always had her own bottle of Dom Perignon that no one was allowed to touch. She loved to dance to 70s music, things like Sister Sledge's We Are Family and Van McCoy's The Hustle, during which she'd force everyone to do the actual hustle. She usually only wanted to play disco. Oh, and Britney Spears' Toxic. She took hip-hop dance classes at our house in Hidden Hills. She made me do it too, but I wasn't very good. She had me do everything with her. At some point, she had learned a dance to Creep by TLC, and when she dropped me off at a sleepover in the valley, she stayed to teach me and my friends the moves. She would often hang out with us. She would say, "Your friends are my friends." At some point that night in Hawaii, Maggie May came on and we all shouted along to it, people dancing on tables until the wee hours. Around 3 a.m., I took a break, lying on the lawn chair to look at the stars. In Hawaii, anytime you stargaze, you'll see shooting stars. And there they were, rushing past my peripheral vision. My mom came to join me, and we lay there together watching the streaking lights. I said, "My stomach hurts." She said, "That's because you've been drinking my Dom Perignon." Eventually, we realized that someone was missing. In the 5-minute trip from the beach to the house, we'd somehow managed to lose my dad. This was not uncommon when we were partying, as he was always the wild card. But I was slightly worried, so Ben and his friends headed back out to find him. They returned without my dad, but with a giant toad they discovered. My mom never worried about my dad. "He'll outlive us all," she would say. At one point during the dance party, I noticed a figure in the distance approaching our backyard, coming out of the huge, jagged lava rock that loomed behind our house. My dad was shirtless and had a tiny dot of blood on his nose. No one had any idea how he even managed to make it through the lava or what he had been doing out there. This was not uncommon with Danny. He would just show up with a cheeky smile on his face as though nothing had happened. but everything had happened. The night continued like so many others. My mom and dad dancing together, laughing in their own world. They always felt like a pair of pirates to me. As I headed off to bed, I could never last as long as my parents. I noticed that my dad had taken off the rest of his clothes and was now sitting naked in a lawn chair, calmly drinking champagne with my mother's security guards. My mother desperately wanted a normal life, and Michael Lockwood felt like her last shot at it. It seemed that in Michael, she felt she found a person who could help her stop running from stability. As my mother began to consider getting married again, she reassessed her relationship with her own mom, and they grew closer, not just for the sake of me and my brother, but for each other, to try to heal what had been done. My mom wrote the song Raven for Priscilla. I'll hear your stories that filled your sad eyes when you had raven hair. Hold your head up high. I know that I've been ruthless. I've been ruthless. Go on, dry your eyes. Hey, you finally see me. Hi, and I see you. And everything till now, it wasn't that bad, really. Beautiful lady, go on, dry your eyes. You know that I've forgiven you, and I'm sorry. And everything till now, it wasn't that bad, really. Beautiful lady. My mom wanted to forgive her, and she wanted to own her part in their difficult relationship. Those lyrics meant the world to her mom. After that, Nona would come on tour and get so excited to hear her song. In fact, my grandma and mom were thick as thieves for a minute. They were always giggling and laughing and having fun and getting drunk together, constantly up to no good. In 2005, my mother and Michael got engaged in Hawaii. I remember her coming back to our house in Hidden Hills and showing me the ring in our kitchen. My mother was in love with Japan and its culture, and she really wanted to have a traditional Japanese wedding. So they married in Kyoto in January 2006. Around 20 of us traveled to Japan for the ceremony. I was 2 days late because I had the stomach flu. My dad, who would be the best man at the wedding, waited back and then flew with me to Tokyo. From Tokyo, we all took the train to Kyoto, where we stayed in a traditional ryokan. The day after I got into Kyoto, my mom and I had a customary Japanese breakfast of fish, miso soup, and rice, but I ordered a side of white bread and jam because I'd never seen such a fluffy piece of bread in my life. Breakfast over, my best friend and I accompanied my mom and her mom to a dress shop where we all got fitted for traditional wedding kimonos. At the rehearsal dinner, I remember my mom motioning for me to go outside with her. We set off along a beautiful old tiny road, like pretty much every road in Kyoto, together, smoking cigarettes. During the walk, my mom said, "I'm having a panic attack in there, I don't know why." We walked a little farther and she said, "I felt stuck at that table, I needed to go outside." I was just 16 at the time and not sure what was going on, though I figured maybe she was afraid of commitment. Maybe she knew somewhere in her that this was the beginning of the last chapter. Nevertheless, the next day my mother got married in the backyard of the ryokan. I will always remember how beautiful she looked. After the wedding, we took a train to Hakone and the hot springs of Gorakudan on the grounds of Kanenomiya Villa, the former summer villa of a member of the imperial family. This was one of my mother's favorite places on earth. She loved the hotel and the hot springs. I vividly remember the two of us washing our bodies, sitting on little stools before we entered the baths. We didn't say anything. I think we were both just taking in the beauty that was all around us and how lucky we felt to be there and with each other. Later that night, we, in our kimonos, went down to the karaoke bar inside the hotel, the one place on the property where it's okay to let go a little bit. In fact, I think it's welcome. Michael Lockwood sang Let's Dance by David Bowie. My dad sang Wild Thing by the Troggs. My mother and I sang Elton John's Your Song together. Then I sang two ABBA songs with my best friend, my mom joining in with Chiquitita, until the three of us ended up sitting on the floor crying because we were laughing so much. By the end of the night, my dad was dancing with Priscilla, my brother was excitedly running around with his friend, and me and my mom were duetting with the locals, as you do. My mom desperately wanted more children. She did many rounds of IVF and eventually she got pregnant. During her pregnancy with my sisters, she rented a house in Montecito as the first chapter of a sort of fairy tale life she wanted to create for herself with her new babies. She was away from LA. It was a beautiful summer, and we would spend these gorgeous days enjoying her being pregnant in her peaceful garden. My mom could strongly sense in a deeply spiritual way who these two beings inside her were. She felt that Harper would be delicate and feminine and strong, Finley sassy and stubborn and sweet, and she was right. That's who they are. My mother was like a hurricane, yet everyone notices how sweet and gentle her kids are. In October 2008, she gave birth to twin daughters, my dear sisters, Harper Vivian Ann Lockwood, named after Michael's mother and Priscilla, and Finley Aaron Love Lockwood, named after Gladys and Elvis. Harper and Finley were just the sweetest little babies. They were born via C-section at Los Robles Hospital in Thousand Oaks. I, along with Michael Lockwood, was present when my mom had her C-section. When they came out, I remember thinking that they looked just how we thought they would. Both of them had the Cupid bow lips and heavy eyelids we all have. I was 19 and they felt like my babies too. After my mom's C-section, it was important to get her up and moving as soon as possible, so we'd walk the halls of the hospital together, her hanging on to her little walker. She hated doing it, but to cheer her up, I'd talk to her in this weird language she, Ben, and I had come up with when we were really little. She had something similar with her dad. If we really wanted to, we could use that language and no one else could understand us. Each day, I'd come into her room and she'd be grumpy and in pain, and I'd say, "Do you want to stroll the aisles of Robles?" And off we'd go, laughing hysterically. Eventually, the twins came home and we all set about feeding and burping these two angels. Their father would feed one, my mom would feed the other, and I'd be on burping duty. I usually slept in a cot in the room. I loved getting up in the night with the babies. We were all so close. If we were at a hotel, my sisters would sleep in bed with my mom and I would sleep on a cot at their feet. We were always in the same room together. My mom was so intuitive and instinctual when it came to being a mother. She knew instantly that Finley liked to be held this way and Harper that way. I don't know where she got it from. I don't think it was something that had been passed on to her necessarily. I think she was born that way. Circumstances shape a person, but there's a part of you that's your spirit. And my mom's spirit was brimming with maternal love. For years, she had wanted another chance to be a mother. With me and Ben, she had been a young mom. This time, she wanted to do it over and be more thoughtful about it and spend more time with her kids. She didn't want tons of staff and nannies raising them. She wanted to do it all herself, hands-on. Ben's and my childhoods were perfect, amazing, and yet my mom still wanted to do a better job the second time around, to be even more present and do everything herself. So she concocted a plan. She was going to sell the LA house and move to England and have a beautiful life in the country, where my sisters would have a country garden where they could go for walks every morning and would grow up with cute British accents. This is one of the most heartbreaking things about the last decade of her life. Being a mother was the most important thing to her. She had really wanted another chance at it, and yet her addiction showed up. Her father had been an addict, but there was scant awareness of it in the 1970s. Back then, everyone in Hollywood seemed to be an addict, but no one had language for it. Elvis had thought he was just doing what his doctors advised. If the doctor told him to take a drug to go to sleep and one to wake up, that's what he did. His intentions were pure, So there might have been a genetic component to my mom's addiction. Either way, it just waited around all her life until right after my sisters were born. And then it showed up and burned everything down. My mother's life soon got to a point where she began to feel out of control. She had so many staff running everything for her that she didn't know simple things like how to turn on the living room TV. She had had a great run, a whole decade of letting people in, trusting them. Yet money was a part of her life that she had virtually no awareness about. One day, she caught wind that a certain staff member had maybe misused the company credit card. She began to look into it and found that some staff members were overcharging her cards in ways she didn't feel good about. Too many flights purchased, too many new phones, too many pizzas. Most of these staff members were also her best friends. They weren't thieves. Maybe they just got a little lazy. But for my mother, it released the dormant feeling that everyone around her had an agenda. Even deeper than that, she thought she was unlovable. The way she would handle these feelings was to exile people, regardless of how big or how small the offense. At the end of that idyllic 10 years, virtually overnight, my mother had let everybody go at Hidden Hills. Friends, security, assistants, people she had known and loved for years, her religion. She just suddenly wanted everything gone. One by one, they were sent away. The only people who remained were her children, Michael Lockwood, and of course, my dad. Something in her heart had never left Graceland, hadn't emotionally developed past when her father died. She said herself how much she wanted friends. But after nearly 40 years of continuous letdowns, people selling her out to the press, being irresponsible with her money, dating her for the wrong reasons, she learned to cut people out of her life and not look back. For the first time in her life, she wanted to be alone. One day she left the house by herself, which she never did, and went to a little independent theater in Woodland Hills to watch any movie she could find. They happened to be showing Into the Wild. She didn't know anything about the film ahead of time. Her seeing that movie is the first thing I remember my mother ever doing by herself. I was concerned, but I also remember thinking, what a serendipitous movie to have come upon. A film about a young, idealistic man setting out into the wilderness on his own, finding his identity through isolation, but it ends in tragedy.
I can get really mean and really angry, and I freak people out when I get like that. It comes from trying to protect myself from pain. I just push people the fuck away. It's the fear of being hurt. I know people can hurt me, so I'll shut them out. I learned from the best, Michael Jackson. He did it really well. But even as a child, I remember being really angry with my aunt one time, and I said, I disown you. Don't ever talk to me again. My aunt. I'm super sensitive and scared and not secure with who I am. I don't know who I am. I never really got the chance to uncover my own identity. I didn't have a family. I didn't have a childhood. And though some of it was fun, there was also constant trouble. And then I woke up. I woke up about a lot of stuff that had been going on around me for years. A lot of people were invested in having me quiet and manageable.
By then, unbeknownst to all of us, she was regularly taking the opioids prescribed to her after the C-section she'd had for my sister's birth.
After my C-section, I got the high the first time. And where I just let everything go. And my mind went like jello, my body went like jello, and everything was great. I loved everybody. Everything was fine.